Hi there, and welcome to the very first episode of season two of Cybest.
Woohoo!
We're a podcast about science, popular culture, and entertainment, and we're your hosts, Isabel.
And Ella. And we are two science communicators and sci-fi nerds steering this spaceship alongside guests this season for the very first time into the multiverse of science fun. And today's episode, we are talking about science that goes pop. So science that's related to popular culture, creative science, different ways to engage that are beyond the ivory tower and accessible to a wider variety of people. More on that later.
Mm-hmm. And this episode, like all the episodes in this season, are going to be structured a little bit differently. And today we have a very special guest, our friend and science communication colleague, Dr. Anna Sophie Juergens. Anna Sophie, you want to say hi?
Hi.
So just quickly before we dive into today's topic and all the super cool things Anna Sophie gets up to, it's really important that we acknowledge this episode of Cybest is being recorded on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country. Indigenous Australians are the first artists, first scientists, and we'd like to pay our respects to elders past, present, emerging, and future. And to open this season, I also wanted to highlight Australian First Nations peoples as the first and longest continuing science communicators, tracing back to the first tellings of the Yorta Yorta Cadell Fault story, which is a story about the uplift of the Cadell Fault across their ancestral river, which caused a large flood and created a new wetland forest ecosystem. This is an event that occurred over 30,000 years ago and was witnessed by ancestors of the Yorta Yorta Nation, who transmitted this knowledge and the story through countless generations and continue to tell the story today.
Amazing. So let's kick off this very first episode, and I'll just do a little quick introduction to the topic to whet our appetites for what's to come. Today we are talking all things popular culture. And popular culture is a really cool, important, and significant aspect and friend for science storytelling, engagement, and communication. Popular culture is an excellent vehicle for science, and science is an excellent vehicle for popular culture. They go hand in hand. And today we're really excited to talk about things in science that go beyond academic journals or beyond information that's kept in establishments that are only open to a certain amount of people. And we're going to be talking about how popular culture helps science in the real world. We're talking about cool new ways and exciting places that you might not think science is in. And we're going to talk all about science engagement beyond just the academic. We're talking things like pop-up books, movie screenings, and so much more. And to talk about this with, we have our amazing guest, Dr. Anna Sophie Juergens.
Yeah, thanks, Ella, for that intro. I'm going to introduce our guest today. So Anna Sophie is a senior lecturer in science communication and popular entertainment studies at the Australian National Centre for the Public Awareness of Science, and creator of the PopSecure, the science in pop culture and entertainment hub at the Australian National University.
It's pretty cool.
It is.
It is.
You should join it.
We're not biased at all.
Become a PopSecureist. We will say more about that in due course.
Anna Sophie explores the cultural meanings of science and is particularly fascinated by extreme, hyperbolic, and outrageous characters in culture, like clowns and mad scientists. She has published on the history of comic mad scientists, clown robots, Joker science, science and humour, comic performance and technology, science and environmental art, sci-com and street art. She's basically interested in everything.
Like, almost, yeah.
All the cool things.
And she's published on so many more topics as well. So she hails from the world of comparative literature, having completed a master's thesis on the connections between mythology and aerial acrobatics.
You got it.
The title was Hermetical Love Acrobatics.
Oh, there you
go. I will say more about that in a second if you want.
Okay, awesome. And also a PhD on hyperbolic circus aesthetics in Western fiction and culture. Anna Sophie, quote, discovers wormholes between distant thematic galaxies and builds bridges between unconnected stars, end quote. that's on her PopSecure bio, and I just really wanted to include it because I thought it was a great way that summarized Anna Sophie. So welcome, Anna Sophie, and thanks so much for coming on SciBurst.
Thanks for having me here.
Awesome. So you have so many exciting things going on all the time. I feel like every time I talk to you, you have another project that's popping up.
Reference the eight new things we spoke about before beginning this podcast recording.
Yeah. And you're great at making connections between completely different, or what may seem like completely different, topics and ideas. And so I'm really interested to hear, and I think our listeners would be too, how you got from circuses, clowns, comparative literature to the world of science communication.
That's a very good question, and it all started when I studied literature, obviously. And I discovered that there are many extreme and fascinating characters in literature from the end of the 19th century. So that's the time I'm most interested in, so the time of modernity and modernism, when technologies changed the way people thought about themselves and life and art and traveling and time and space, basically. And at that time, circuses were fantastically important. Take Netflix, Disney, Hollywood, Smurfs, whatever you define as pop culture, all this together, that was the circus around 1900. So circuses influenced the way people thought about travel. They essentially contribute to the railroad system in the US, for example. They shaped fashion, they shaped ideas about bodies, and they were really major cultural institutions at the end of the 19th century. And while working on my thesis, I realized that there's a research gap around these cultural powers and cultural achievements of circus and how they are reflected on and thought and reimagined in fiction. And so I wrote that master thesis on the relationship between mythology and clowning in one of the most outrageous books that you can possibly imagine. Actually, you can't imagine it. It's called Against the Grain by Joris Karl Huysmans. It's a French novel, A Rebours in French. And in this novel, the character is just the essence of decadence. He lives during the night because living in daylight is just too primitive. And for example, and it's getting wilder and wilder, but at one point he reflects on his fascination for an aerial acrobat called Miss Urania and how this gender-bending character in the kind of under the big top of a circus, what kind of fantasies this character induced and inspired him. And then he was so disappointed that it was just a woman as the actual story says. So it's polarizing, it's challenging, it's strange, but it launched this huge discussion around what is sophistication in culture, what is over-sophistication, what is extremism. And the picture of Dorian Gray and many other famous novels refer to and quote and reflect on this particular novel. Anyway, what I want to say is there is a mixture between mythology and clowning and aerial acrobatics that I thought was very provocative and interesting. And while working on that topic, I realized there are so many more things that have to be discussed and explored. So I wrote my thesis on circus and fiction, as you just introduced. Yeah. And I was really interested in understanding the difference between so-called real-life circus and the imaginaries that we have in fiction. Because circus in fiction is very different than circus in so-called real life. So it's extreme, it's fantastic, it's exaggerated, and I wanted to really unpack and clarify what that actually means. And while doing so, I realized that there are so many circuses in Australian fiction. It was one of the major insights I had, so I discovered Australian fiction, having a background in French and Russian literature before. But I also saw that there are many relationships between extreme characters on popular stages and scientists. So clowns are extreme. We know that. They have feet that are way too big. They have noses. They're way too red. They engage in incredible adventures for comic effect, but they also use technology for comic effects on stages. So they have lawnmowers that, as you can imagine, do horrible things, but in a comical way. They have big hammers and mallets. They, in many ways, they use technology as a way of imagineering and engineering comic stories and comic dramas on stages. So there's a use of technology, and circus has always been associated with the cutting edge of technology. So beyond clowning, we had, for example, sword fights with electrical weapons at the end of the 19th century, way before Star Wars even was on the horizon. And we had electrical ladies, and really electricity rewired what we thought popular entertainment was. And now I'm kind of actually answering your question. While studying circuses and the impact of circus on culture and in culture, I realized there are many spaces where circus aesthetics, routines, and really stories intertwine with science. So, for example, one of the major entrepreneurs and circus humans in the universe, P.T. Barnum, before creating what was to become the major circus, so his before creating the Greatest Show on Earth, he actually had a museum, the so-called American Museum, and that museum, he featured a naturalist, and he had rare species and also donated specimens to Harvard and the Smithsonian. So he had a naturalist to add validity and more value to some of his actually fantastic exhibits that were exhibited at the intersection between science and fantasy. So he also employed that naturalist, and he also had professors as part of his museum, like an upside-down walker, professor for upside-down walking. He had a phrenologist. And so that taps into what in the research is called wondrous science. So science that presents realism that is thoroughly flexible and, well, imaginative at the end, close to invention. And we have these phenomena in other popular entertainment spaces as well. So circus thought and defined broadly, we have magicians. Magicians are called the scientists of show business because they actually manipulated.
I love that so much.
Yeah, me too.
They manipulated perceptions. They used and still use engineering to create their effects and tricks on stage. But we also had, for example, flea circus performers who were always presented by so-called professors. So professors, flea professors, for example. And again, they use a sort of science that is marvelous and fantastic, but that in many ways kind of that shaped what we thought or people thought at that time about science. And these spaces and exhibits, they also acted as mediators of knowledge in spaces that brought together ideas about science and ideas about entertainment.
Yeah.
So it sounds, it may sound strange, but if you dig a bit deeper, you find many connections that actually show it's kind of an organic development or an organic kind of
like
journey of discovery.
Starting
with circus, but moving into these more science spaces.
It's actually making me think about some of the work we've done previously at Cybernetics on like robot displays and like automata. I mean, all the exhibitions around that too. I can see the, yeah, the connections there.
Yeah.
And there were performances in which humans performed as automata.
Yes, yeah.
And they were performances that used these strategies that I just mentioned of surprise, of humor, of the unexpected to generate comic effects for entertainment. But at the same time, they also reflected the state of science and engineerial or engineering.
Yeah.
I'm really interested, Anna-Sophie, about how far into studying circuses and clowns did you get before the links to science were so, just like so obvious?
Yeah.
Was it, you know, like first week and then you're like, oh, I'm in this science communication field, or, you know, was it a lot further down the line? Like how big and obvious were these connections? Is it surface level, or is like, you dig a little deeper and then it all opens up? What was your experience like there?
Well, it took quite a few years, I would say 8 years, to unfold and really understand these connections, how they shape the past but also our present. So I'm most interested in understanding research as a conversation between the past and present, and potentially future as well. So I don't want
phrasing
to stop in the 19th century. I want to understand how these phenomena actually influence what we think today, and who we are today and who we can become. So it's an ongoing, still learning experience, but it took a while to read about circus. And circus is intricate and intriguing because a lot of the circus history, or many phenomena in circus history, were actually written by circus staff. So if you have newspaper reports about circus performances, often they were engineered or imagineered by circus journalists and circus writers. So often you don't actually know what happened on stage. And so
yes,
there's a lot of...
I know, because it's only the papers and...
creative imagination around that. So understanding the past is always... it's not a documentary.
You know?
Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think I was just interested to ask because... I would say a lot of people in my life, if I go, oh, you know, circuses and science, people be waiting for me to make that connection for them. It's not a connection that comes super easily, I think, to a lot of people at the moment. So I was just wondering what your, how you found that journey. And it sounds like it's one still in the making and, ongoing today.
In 2018, I organized a big conference at the ANU around circus and science. And that conference really showed us the multifacetedness, the multitude and multiverse, there we go, the multiverse of circus and science connections, because we had science shows at QuestaCon, we had a science film night where we looked at archival material, so the formats that you can study are very rich in themselves. So you can study archival material, but you can also look into the history of fashion and understand how, for example, certain powders and makeup influenced the way people looked and influenced not just the way people looked on stage, but also in the so-called Bobo, bourgeois bohemian universe. I just learned that word.
It's a new one to me.
So it's intricate and there's so much more to discover. And I also, I have to say that I only looked into more Western, European, American, Australian contexts. So, so many more words.
I know this. I know it sounds like there's so much more to explore there. And so now you're in the world of science communication. What led you to start Popsicle, or what inspired you to start that?
Yeah, so Popsicle, our science and pop culture and entertainment hub, is a method and result of science communication. So it's a stage for our research to be celebrated and discussed and made visible, but it's also a stage for our students where they can publish their outstanding work, and our students only do outstanding works. But it's also to highlight and showcase our collaborations. It's a space where Cyburst is hosted, for example.
Yeah, we are. In fact.
Wow, that sounds like a really cool podcast.
Check it out on the Popsicle website. So it's really a lively hub where you can find out about our courses in this space. For example, we have two courses. We have a course on science and humor and a course on science and popular fiction. And really, this is a stage and a place where we want to excite the public imagination about science and raise awareness about the power of pop culture and science and pop culture to really shape our ideas about science, our attitudes towards science. And we want to unpack pop culture as a site where we reflect on our anxieties and fears, and desires and hopes about our technological future and scientific being in the future.
Yeah, totally. And I think you and I have definitely experienced this, and Ella might have as well, but in our research, we have always had to justify why pop culture is important to be studying for science, and I feel like Popsicle is also a place for that too, to show, hey, pop culture is really important and powerful for science, so we should all be studying this.
Totally. And there's a wonderful quote by science communicator David Kirby, who says that science and entertainment are two of the most powerful cultural institutions that we have developed to understand and shape and envision our world. And this is exactly what we want to unpack and clarify and also shape in collaboration with performers and artists, creative minds, and of course, scientists and academics and students.
Yeah, I guess pop culture is such a good and important vehicle, and it's great that we have a new PopSecure, not just for Cyburst, but I think also as a hub to identify how many people and projects there are going on. I love looking through the collaborators page, and you get to see all these faces of people who are all doing really cool projects in the space, and you get a sense for how big it is and potentially people doing work in interdisciplinary areas too.
We have a few projects and PopSecularities within this PopSecure, and if you don't mind, I can
go for it. Yeah.
So if you go on our website, you can see that we have an entire research stream around science, art, and film. So that's where we discuss the facets and dynamics and representations and identities of science and science characters in blockbuster cinema. So we run a film series called the Science Art Film Series every month that wants to unpack the weird, wacky, and wonderful facets of science. And we started that a few years ago. We talked about things like Mars attacks and science from outer space, our nuclear future in relation to Acura, and you can find out more on the website. So it's very lively. If you are in Canberra, check it out and join.
Yeah, it's great. Listeners might remember that we launched an episode for one of their science art film nights, which was the comic
Batman and Robin.
Yes, Batman and Robin. So
So that's ongoing, very lively, very easy to access as well, because that's in a beautiful cinema. Tickets are for free, and we have super inspiring speakers. We also have a stream around parasites and viruses.
Oh yeah, that stuff's so cool.
So we collaborate with parasitologist Alexander Meyer, who is really interested in changing our awareness about the reputation of parasites. So parasites have a bad reputation.
Yes.
They kind of seem to be ugly. They spread diseases. But they're actually really important for our ecosystem.
Mm.
And they are part of us, and we can learn a lot about ourselves, their hosts, if we study parasites. So all of this has been reflected in culture actually before this awareness became more widespread in our science context. Mm-hmm. And so that's ongoing research with the virologist, Professor David Charkey. We look into things like Joker science and viruses in comics, because our most popular nightmare, the Joker, spreads himself, being via viruses in many of his stories. And often there's actual science featured or a science fantasy salad. And we are really interested in discussing what is going on in these comics and what are the strategies of science and why is science so popular and everywhere in the DC universe.
Yeah.
Anyway, to cut that short, there are a few more streams and PopSecularities that we explore. Science and humor is a bit big topic.
Yeah.
But we also have science and street art, science, street art, and engagement projects, and also the famous pop-up project that Ella just mentioned at the beginning. So we are also interested in developing new formats of science communication.
Yeah, and you've also got that ICE stages.
Yeah, we have a research stream around extreme environments.
Yeah,
in which we are interested in kind of exploring environmental awareness, environmental urgencies, and environmental fragility through pop cultural aesthetics and pop cultural media. So what can we learn about climate change from Ice Age, Happy Feet, for example? Mm-hmm. And what can science shows and ice science spectaculars and other performance types that use science to communicate environmental concerns and also hopes, how can they actually be raise awareness, made useful, inspire and stimulate interest in saving our planet, but also in STEM fields of research.
Mm-hmm. Huge. And there's a book launch happening really soon for some work you've done in that area, which by the time we release this episode will be out, so people can go have a look too.
Yeah, true.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so the book is called The book is called Communicating Ice Through Popular Art and Aesthetics, and it will be published, or is published, in the Palgrave series in Media and Environmental Communication. It's very interdisciplinary. It's really fascinating because it brings together scholars from pop cultural studies, environmental studies, Arctic research. We have an oceanographer, art historians, and all this together really is also needed to understand the complex issue of melting ice and its cultural relevance and impact.
Yeah, and I'm just going off that, I'm super interested in obviously pop culture we've seen works really well for science, STEM, and science communication. I was wondering if pop culture is just such a good universal communicator for so many subjects and so many different disciplines, or is there really something about pop culture mixing with STEM that is just like the secret duo, the secret pairing that just is amazing and for success and, you know, fulfills all of us?
I would say yes and no. So it's definitely a fantastic vehicle for science, and for us, that's the focus of what we do at the Australian National Centre for the Public Awareness of Science in this space. But of course, there are so many other things that you can discuss and that are discussed in fields, and there are actual research fields like pop culture studies, popular entertainment studies, film studies, comic studies, humor studies.
So yeah.
There are entire disciplines that dedicate their research efforts and thinking and creativity to these specific pop cultural items. At the ANU, for example, we have a course in composing, film composing and film music. And the professor, Professor Dr. Ken Lampel, he's an expert on film music. So that's kind of a pop cultural thing.
Yeah.
He might actually be an interesting speaker for you. that's the one who created the soundtrack for Pokemon.
Oh, yes. So, you were telling us. that's right.
We got to get him on the podcast.
Definitely, you should. He's amazing. So there are many... there's so much power, so many different ways you can talk about pop culture and really activate thinking and creativity in this space.
Yeah, I think it's just a vehicle that anyone can use to talk about a big issue or like spread awareness or want to increase representation in a certain area, whether that's STEM or like law or arts or...
Yeah. You know? I just feel like it hits different when it's paired with science.
Yeah, I don't know if that's just because we're biased though.
Probably.
Because we come from that world.
Well, pop culture narratives really have affected the public discourse and understanding of science. And one of your questions was about impact, if I remember correctly.
That's the next question actually.
Okay. Yeah. And I think, well, there's so much to say about how science influenced pop culture and pop culture influenced science, and books have been written about that. Lab Coats in Hollywood by David Kirby is one of them.
Yeah.
We have a course here, as I just mentioned, by Dr. Brett Tucker, one of our colleagues, who really is kind of dedicated to this space. And Brett, I think he would be another great speaker for you as well.
We were actually talking about that yesterday.
so he would be amazing to discuss some of the details in the sci-fi space in particular. But speaking about that, I thought, we also have not just beyond sci-fi, we have things like, well, it's actually sci-fi, X-Files is sci-fi, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So X-Files is famous for having inspired young women to be interested in STEM.
The Scully effect.
Famous Scully effect. Yeah. So I brought an example that really goes back to the influence of spectacle and popular culture on science filmmaking and thus on science. So if there's a spectrum of influences, I would love to give an example that is at the beginning, and then maybe Brett Tucker can talk about the contemporary stuff. So there was this illusionist and magician actually called Georges Méliès in France, who is one of our first early filmmakers. And he really created amazing, incredible films that feature all these frenetic scientists, maniacs, umbrella-waving maniacs that you might associate with early films, black and white.
Yeah.
And there's one film from 1902 called A Trip to the Moon, or in French, Le Voyage dans la Lune.
Yeah,
it's one of our earliest science films. And the film is just 14 minutes. It's about a group of scientists. And they build a rocket and they travel to the moon where they encounter aliens and other weirdos. And then they return home to a fanfare and really are celebrated. That's all. But this film really established the creator, Georges Méliès, as a king of tricks and as the father of so-called cinema of attractions. So early films, they were heavily influenced by popular entertainment strategies. Circus routines, routines from clowns and comedians, but also body aesthetics and acrobatics. So there are many acrobatics. So there are jumping mm-hmm. aliens. And it's all wild for today's perspective, but the entire film is kind of made out of acts.
Yes.
And that's kind of that has been discussed in film studies, whether it's actually attractions or already a form of narration. But what I want to say is that his camera work was really innovative. The editing was innovative. He used stop motion and time-lapse photography and really created this visual curiosity around science and space traveling. So he combined filmmaking with strategy used on popular stages before. And what he created was a fantasy, a science fantasy.
Yes.
And it's also called the first science fiction film, actually.
Wow, and I actually didn't know that.
What he used was a mixture of special effects, new special effects, a space journey narrative, whether it was kind of in act style or not, it's still called a narrative, so they travel, come back. And they also he also used image symbols. So from an academic perspective, he used diegesis and semiotics to create something that hasn't existed before and that really influenced all of our science fiction films. So Fritz Lang, Ridley Scott, everyone is kind of part of this cultural continuity that you can... I'm also getting already goosebumps.
Just thinking about how amazing it is.
Fascinating stuff. So this film is the beginning of an entire tradition of filmmaking, of space films, of special effects space films, of traveling to the moon and coming back, of showing aliens. And so that's an example of how things from pop cultural spaces, aesthetics, routines, tricks. As I said, Georges Méliès was a magician, so he used some of these tricks in the film. How all of that together, combined in a new medium, really influenced what we think about pop culture and how we basically define pop culture. Because for many, sci-fi is one of the most important facets or phenomena of pop culture.
Yeah, totally. Wow, that's a great example. Thank you.
So that's another example of how the past has influenced and continues to influence our present and our current films.
Yeah, I love that stuff too. I love it when there's intertextuality in movies. Like I get, that's something I'm super nerdy about. I get really excited when I'm doing that.
Yeah, and I love the innovation and kind of STEM interplay of like the methods of making the movie as well as the output of the movie as well. It feels very balanced kind of on both sides of the act of creation and then also the thing you've created, both stemming from really interesting and innovative ideas and places.
Yeah, and it also shows us how complex these elements are that we see now in all kinds of science fiction films, that they were transformed or adapted from a different media, and that media, popular performance itself, changed dramatically when the new medium of film blossomed and became widespread and popular. So many of the former locations and venues of popular entertainment, the Folies Bergères and many vaudeville and café concert and music halls, they were actually physically transformed into film theaters and movie theaters. So you could see there was this transition between cultural media and mediums that totally changed our perception of the world. Because film really opened up so many new, fantastically new perspectives to basically everything. You could look into a laboratory of a scientist, for example. That's a secluded space that people normally don't have access to.
So very true.
Now you can show things and also fantasize about colorful, you know, liquids and exploding beakers and all this wild imaginative stuff.
Anna-Sophie, what is a typical day like for you? You have all these projects on the go. You have a gazillion collaborators, it seems like. You're incredible. You're multilingual. You're a woman in STEM, which is normally a male-dominated field. You've kind of got all these things into playing at the same time.
Yeah.
I feel like you must fit like 17 days in a normal day.
I think I don't have a typical day.
Oh.
So I would say I have days that revolve around research. Like I try to work on my own monograph around humor and science and pop culture. I have days where I teach. For example, our science and humor course, days of conferencing where you basically spend the entire day just networking and discussing.
Yeah.
And but I would say most of my days, they include some creative thinking and plotting and scheming and developing of new projects and ideally also discoveries. So I would say almost every day I discover something new and exciting, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's super cool. Mm. Do you think your days are similar to a lot of science communicators? Would you say your day is more similar to a pop culture specialist? Like where do you kind of sit on the intersection, or do you think those 2 days are more alike than we may seem?
Whoa.
No biggie.
I would say we all have our own typical days. And I mean, I can't speak for other scholars who, I don't know, work abroad or have different media they study. So Ken Lempel, for example, he spends his, I imagine Ken Lempel, for example, from the School of Music, he spends his entire day looking at, studying, and listening to music. So that's a pop cultural scholar in a way. I hope he doesn't mind that I say that. So that's a very different day than I have. But the beauty is that there's a lot of space to shape and develop your own day.
Mm. I mean, I would say I don't really have a typical day either. But I also work for someone who is not also, like, typical either. So yeah, I mean, I do, like, so many different things every day, and it changes as well. Just, no, yeah. I love that answer.
I think it's really cool, and one of my favorite things about doing this, like, science communication and popular culture, or science culture and popular communication, if we want to go the route that my brain was making me speak in. I think one of my favorite things is displaying aspects of science and STEM that people might not typically think of or typically associate with. And I think other than scientists who work in a lab, I think our cultural consciousness is quite small about what goes on day to day for someone in science or in a STEM-related field. So I think it's really cool to talk about these things and open up a communication, a conversation around it too.
Mm, yeah, for sure. And I guess to just bring things together, we've obviously talked about there are so many avenues that you're exploring and Anna-Sophie that others are exploring for science communication to do with different areas of pop culture. So that's like pop-up books, film, comics, street art. I would love to hear a realm of pop culture that we haven't yet explored for SciComm. And I would love if it's also a wild answer.
I have an answer for you.
Yes. Oh, yes. I'm so excited.
I think we could look into tattoos,
oh,
a form of science communication.
Great answer.
There's also a forensic biologist in Germany called Mark Benecke, who is the incarnation of what you can do with science, tattoos, and communication.
Wow.
Check out his Insta account. He loves describing crime scenes. He loves talking about all the grotesque and morbid elements of his research. It's a character. It's a phenomenon. So if you are interested in wild and crazy stuff that also has a communication aspect, yeah, he would be an interesting person to talk to. Maybe you can get him on on your Cybers podcast.
I think a little bit of context we maybe left out of Anna-Sophie's introduction is that she was so fundamental to setting up of Cyburst and giving us a space, and she's also a tireless advocate for us, and throughout this episode you've heard her be like, this person, you should speak to them. It's so amazing. This is a very, very real dynamic that exists outside the podcast studio.
Yeah,
as well.
And now it's just translating into this podcast recording. It's great. I okay, tattoos,
Let's.
Yeah, because they are like street art.
Yeah.
They are
okay.
Visible. They are kind of in the public space. If they are visible, they address everybody, if you want it or not. You are exposed to them if they are visibly kind of exhibited or displayed. And that raises all kinds of questions between privacy and visibility and what is public art? Is art tattoos public art? Are they
Good question.
And sometimes you do have science related, what do you call them, designs or topics or themes. Like there's an entire community around Geiger tattoos and coming back to sci-fis, alien tattoos. There are communities in social media who discuss their own Geiger tattoos where you have, well, aliens and all kinds of intricate and really, really art. I mean, that's art in many ways. Tattoos can be horrible. They can be, again, on a spectrum of things, but they can also be real art and beautiful and fascinating. And some of them actually tap into pop culture and science-related films and formats and products. And then I think it gets interesting.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I've definitely seen a lot of tattoos that are like pop culture tattoos and sci-fi tattoos, like lots of UFO tattoos, that sort of thing. Aliens, like you said.
Yep.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Now I want to do a project on that.
Welcome. At any time.
This is all part of the plan.
Yeah. I don't know. Have you seen any science tattoos, Ella?
It's interesting. So my sister has a little solar system tattoo.
There you go.
But also
science on bodies.
How popular are botanical tattoos?
True.
And that, you know, goes back to, cyanotype prints when photos and getting those printed were too expensive. So you make a cyanotype. A lot of architectural students are doing it. That's how we have blueprints. But also a lot of botanical students who at that point in time had to illustrate, so botanical illustrations, this was the cheapest and closest thing that they could get to a photograph by having an actual botanical leaf, stem, flower exposed to sunlight, leaving behind its traces and an imprint in the cyanotype, which is like a blue and white, photo alternative almost. And I think botanical tattoos are super popular, and I think they're very reminiscent of that early interaction between science and art, one that has a history for decades.
Cool. I never thought about it that way before.
Connection I made just then. This is live Ella Brain Thoughts.
This is so funny because we've never done that before.
That was perfect.
Just so our listeners know, what are what do you call this thing?
I like
I don't know what it's called.
Our road podcaster class A
servo biased.
Our roadcaster podcast doc has a bunch of buttons that have sound effects, and today was the perfect time to use it. I'm so happy. We had DJ Anna Sophie on the beats before we started. Just getting us in the mood for a lively podcast. Which I guess now we're at the end of, sadly. But the end can be your favorite part of the podcast. I love this little time where we get to ask our listeners some questions, which are thoughts we want you to go away from this podcast and ruminate on. You can email us about them, catch us on Instagram or LinkedIn or now Mastodon, and let us know your responses. And then we're also going to have some culture recommendations from our guest. But to kick us off, questions for our listeners. Based on today's discussion, everything that's got your creative, imaginative juices in your brain flowing, I would be really interested to know the most fun, unusual, or unexpected way you've experienced science. Has it been through a tattoo? Is there something more cool and unusual you can connect with science in the way that you've engaged with before than that. We would love to know.
Yes. Also, have you ever had a really good time or fun time at an event and then only later realized that it was connected to science?
Like you're on the drive home and then you're like, wait a second. I've just had a science interaction out here.
And so for the recommendations for this season, we are doing them at the end of each episode. And we thought, since you guys always hear Ella and I give recommendations, that we would ask our guests this time to do it. So Anna Sophie, could you recommend three pieces of media for our listeners?
Absolutely. First of all, please check out the PopSicle on the website. You can find the PopSicle also on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, yeah, everywhere. And yeah, explore our projects and popsicularities and get involved, get in touch, become a popsiculist. You can do projects with us, student projects, collaborations, PhDs, postdocs. So we are happy to explore ideas and develop adventures with you. The second recommendation I have is I recently watched a film called Can't Feel Nothing by David Borenstein. It's a film from Denmark. It was part of a film festival that attended in Copenhagen. And it was so ingenious. I watched it twice. It's fantastic.
That is a good review. If you watch a film twice, that is a film worth talking about.
Fantastic.
That film is about how social media influences our emotions, different types of emotions. And it's heavily based on science. It explores science. It features science characters, historical science, but also contemporary science and technology. It's super, super wild. I don't want to spoil it. All these different emotions that are shown and how they are manipulated by what and who and what kind of strategies. It's so mind-blowing and super funny at the same time. So if you can watch it, it's called Can't Feel Nothing and it's absolutely stunning.
Is it on Netflix? Or how do you watch it?
I don't know. I watched it on the, in the cinema as part of the festival. And I'm part of the streaming behind the industry part of the film thing, but it's probably somewhere.
Yeah, listeners, if we find it, we'll include a link so we can all talk about it together.
Yeah.
And the third thing I would like to invite you to explore is called Cybernetic Zoo. It's a website.
I know about this website.
It's not it's not an academic website per se, but it's a incredible collection of historical robots, pre-robots, proto-robots, proto-animal robots, non-human robots, robot machines, and visions of our technological future from the past.
Yes.
So you can do some kind of future archaeology in reading that website. So that's just for inspiration. If you got interested in some of the aspects that we discussed today around historical visions of technology and potential futures, it's a very inspiring website that talks about the historical aspects of contemporary and future technology.
Yeah, I think Ella and I have actually used it for research before when we were looking at history of automata, and it has like loads of information about early automata and tracing it from the beginnings to like present day.
It's almost like an online museum.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess Cybernetic Zoo is a really good name for it in that way.
Yes. Also, did Anna Sophie just perfectly link to our next two episodes?
Maybe she did.
You're going to have to stay tuned for those. So I guess this brings us to the end of our very first episode of season two. Mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you so much, Anna Sophie, for being here and helping us kick off this season, but also Cyburst in general. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Totally.
To our audience, thank you so much for returning back for another season, which we hope you're going to enjoy doubly as much as the last one.
Yeah, we have so many exciting guests and just exciting things happening in general. As always, stay nerdy and we'll see you next time. Thank you to ANU CPASS for their support and access to their podcast studio.